KPBS On Demand is supported by Parks California, in partnership with California State Parks, presents Arts in California Parks, a program offering interactive arts and cultural events in parks throughout the state. Event info at parkscalifornia.org/arts.
It's time for KPBS Midday Edition. On today's show, we hear from Kumeyaay leaders about ways they're honoring and preserving their cultural heritage. I'm Andrew Bowen, in for Jade Hindman, with conversations that keep you informed, inspired, and make you think. It's Native American Heritage Month. A Kumeyaay linguist and educator tells us about his efforts to bring back the endangered indigenous language. And a new coalition forms to raise awareness about missing and murdered indigenous people in San Diego. That's ahead on Midday Edition. Every November, we recognize Native American Heritage Month, honoring the history and contributions of indigenous people. But for many leaders, honoring this history is a year-round commitment. It includes educating the next generation and teaching the public about the truth of the past. Stan Rodriguez is chair of Kumeyaay Studies at Cuyamaca College and past president of Kumeyaay Community College, and he joins me now. Stan, welcome to Midday Edition.
Thank you.
So there are currently three tribal colleges in California. Kumeyaay Community College is one of them. Earlier this year, the Trump administration proposed cutting funding for tribal colleges. And that was before the government shutdown, and there was a proposed one-time increase of funding for tribal colleges. So there seems to be a lot of uncertainty here. How are these funding pressures affecting your work these days in education?
Well, one of the problems that we have here in California is the only college that even has provincial, the ability to stand on their own would be California Indian Nations College in out by Palm Springs. Mm-hmm. The other ones have MOUs with other tertiary institutions, mm-hmm. such as Cuyamaca Community College or the California Tribal College have one with Sacramento State. Mm-hmm. So as far as accrediting bodies go, those universities handle that, and they're working through that. So right now, we haven't felt it, but with this present administration, I wouldn't hold my breath.
Mm. And what is the difference to you between a truly sovereign college that's accredited on its own and one that has to partner with existing educational institutions?
So one of the problems with this is with a tribal college, a true tribal college, we not only write our own curriculum, we bring in our own, organic specialists. Our own native epistemology is taught, and we teach it from a native lens. Whereas when we're working with other tertiary institutions, it's a give and take. So we have much more control when we are a standalone institution.
Mm. Your work is really dedicated to preserving the Kumeyaay language. Mm-hmm. And speaking that language was once forbidden. There were times when Native Americans were forced into boarding schools in the 19th and 20th centuries. How does speaking this language today resist that legacy of trauma?
Sure. Well, one of the reasons why the boarding school started was to eradicate Native culture, spirituality, and language, and create a void that they can implant Western values. And this was seen as a path towards assimilation of the Native people and eventually termination of tribes. So when you have reservations today, that truly is an act of resistance. Same thing with language and culture. I mean, our own spirituality or religion was not legal until the Freedom of American Indian Religion Act was passed in November 11th of 1978. Prior to that, we were prosecuted for these things. So although we have the protection now, damage has been done. There are 3-4 generations of people who don't speak the language. And one thing about California, California has more language and cultural diversity than any other place in the world, aside from Papua New Guinea. With that said, hundreds of tribes in California speaking many different languages. Well, there are many, most of the tribal groups in California have no more speakers. So when we talk about reversing language shift, revitalizing the native language, many times it's reviving a language that is no longer spoken anymore. Can it be done? When Israel was created, people were coming from all over the world. They decided they were going to teach Hebrew. Hebrew hadn't been spoken in over 1,000 years, and they were able to do that. So it can be done. However, there's a lot of obstacles to that.
Mm-hmm. How does learning about the Kumeyaay language teach us about Kumeyaay history?
Language, history, culture, they all support each other. A lot of people never even knew there were natives here in San Diego. This was B.C., before casinos. But then when that happened, then you started hearing about it. But California has more reservations, or San Diego has more reservations than any other county in the country. 18 here, 13 are Kumeyaay. And then there's another 4 to 6 in Baja. The international border cut right through us. So we say our culture, our history, everything was like in a big pot that was shattered. Every community has a part of that. More speakers are in Baja in Mexico than over here. So being able to do that, and the history of the land. You know, I mean, how many of you know when the first Spanish came, or the first Europeans?
Some 15-something, I think.
Yes, yeah. 1542.
42, okay.
And then when the missions came, Junipero Serra in 1769, many people don't know that 3 months after that first mission was created, it was attacked. And then in 1775, the main mission was burned to the ground. There was, and this was in November, so a lot of things happened in November. Even in November 1851, the Gara Uprising took place here in San Diego. So a lot of historical events took place that are not taught. And this is one of the things that we want to teach in our, you know, through a native lens. Mm-hmm.
Much of the Kumeyaay language has been preserved through song. Why is song such a powerful way to teach and to learn?
Mm-hmm. Well, language is what identifies us. And songs tell a narrative. We are an oral people. We didn't have a written language per se. So in our stories, our creation story, and in our songs, this tells a history of it. And an example, song cycles have hundreds of songs in them. Each song tells a story. So when you put it all together, it's like a book, and it tells you about the events that took place in the past.
Would you sing something for us in Kumeyaay?
Sure, I can sing you something. And this song tells a story. Have you ever been in love?
Yes.
Okay. Well, this song tells a story about this one young man who was in love with this one young woman, and he had a horse, and he would take his horse every day to go see her until they told her, you got to go back home. Well, he was so in love, he was reckless. he would go through enemy territory. The enemy would see him going back and forth on that horse. It was a good horse. So one day they laid a trap, and they attached him while he was riding through. He fought to the best of his ability, but he was killed. But the horse kept going and got to the place where his girlfriend was. She looked out of the house that she was living in, and they all seen the horse with blood on it. They went and they found his body and they did what they had to do, but the one young woman, she never got married. She said she will wait until she sees him again. So that's what this song talks about.
Thank you for sharing that.
Sure.
How does it make you feel singing that song? Can you tell me how you learned it and where it came from?
Well, I was a book or an apprentice, and my teacher, Okuchu Mayo, he passed away, but he was a Kwenyume, a wildcat singer, and he had no apprentice, so some of the elders, nudged me his way. And after he interviewed me, well, I guess you'd call it an interview, he wanted to sit down and ask me, you know, why I wanted to be an apprentice. And I told him, he said, all right, well, I'll take you in. And he told me this. He said, I sing alone. And it's like a coyote howling at the moon. When one does it alone, they sound ugly. But when two coyotes howl at the moon together, that's music. He said, we're going to make music. So he was Kumia from Baja, so I would go to different communities in Baja. I was his driver and, you know, his singer too. So I was with him for about 30 years.
Wow. Yeah. How is teaching Kumia language and cultural heritage, what has it taught you about yourself and your own story?
Kumia language is so important because, as I said, that is a form of resistance. It tells us who we are as a people and gives us a way of viewing the universe through a different lens than people who look at it who may speak English or Spanish. And it tells us about this connection with the universe. There are words that we say that you cannot really translate into English. And the way we view the universe in Western society, when we talk about nature, they view humans as different. But we see ourselves as part of that narrative. We are related to everything. It's a different way of viewing things. Same thing when we use a language.
You've devoted your career to higher education. What's your message to the next generation of Kumeyaay leaders and educators?
Education is important. I can't stress that enough. A balanced education. Tertiary education combined with learning our native songs, our native culture, our native language, it will give you a strong base. And this is for anybody, because we're all native from somewhere, everybody on this planet. And if you have that balance, what that teaches, celebration of diversity. Some people, you hear people say, we need to build an atmosphere of tolerance. Well, even that is a negative. Like, I tolerate this inclement weather or something. But taking it farther, celebration of the diversity, we all grow together.
I've been speaking with Stan Rodriguez. He's chair of Kumeyaay Studies at Cuyamaca College and past president of Kumeyaay Community College. Stan, thank you so much for being with here.
Thank you.
Coming up, the journey from thumbing through a Kumeyaay dictionary to studying linguistics. Stay with us.
KPBS On Demand is supported by Paint Care, offering households and businesses in California more than 800 leftover paint drop-off sites for recycling. Quantities of 100-plus gallons of paint may qualify for a large volume pickup. Learn more at paintcare.org.
Welcome back to KPBS Midday Edition. I'm Andrew Bowen, in for Jade Hindman. This hour, we've been talking about the importance of spreading awareness about Kumeyaay language and history. My guest, Nicholas Calloway Smith, is part of the next generation teaching about Kumeyaay heritage. He's an Ipai Kumeyaay educator and linguist. And Nicholas, welcome to Midday Edition.
Yehan, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for being here. I want to start with your own story and relationship to the Kumeyaay language. Was this something you grew up with, or did you pick it up later in life?
So the last speaker in my family was my great-grandmother. She went to a boarding school in Banning called St. Boniface Industrial School, or Indian School. That school really tore all the children down to really be ashamed of their language. And many of them growing up, you know, saw their language as dangerous, you know, for their children to speak, because they didn't want their children to have the same fate as them, you know, being beaten for speaking their own native tongue. Mm-hmm. And so her children didn't get to learn. They didn't. Same with my mom. But I took it upon myself. I was like, you know what? I really want to learn. I really do. Not just for me, but for my ancestors, for my great-grandmother, for my mom, for my grandpa, for my future generations, for my siblings, for my peers, for my community. And so I started learning. Actually, I first started learning through our dictionary. So we have several dictionaries, and there's a lot of grammar notes. And so I started reading them and started searching up on archives, and found a lot of recordings and linguistic documentation. And so that was pretty much my first teachers were our elders who recorded those things. And yeah, and linguists, I know our linguists, and getting to know our speakers today, and been learning as much as I can.
Growing up, what was your education around Kumeyaay culture and history?
Yeah, so I grew up in the Sempasquale Band of Mission Indians, Indian Reservation. And so I'm around it all the time. I went to our education department as a kid. I worked there as well. Our school, we have, let's see, around 5 to 7 tribes. And so I went to Valley Center High School, middle school, elementary school. And we have several tribes that are in one school district. And some of them are Pamquichum, some of them Kupeño, and also Kumeyaay. So seeing different languages, different cultures, you know, in one beautiful, you know, area.
And what made you want to start teaching others about the Kumeyaay language and culture?
So the Kumeyaay language is such a beautiful language, very different from English and Spanish. I think it's so important to see how it intersects with language and culture. So culture and history. And one thing is, you know, I really learned that it's a different worldview. It opens another door to see the world differently. And, you know, English, we love to name things, right? Everything has a label. In Kumeyaay, we describe what it's doing or what it's used for, right? And so a table would be a place where you eat, right? A car, we have several names for a car, but one translation would be the house that runs, right? Or a river, the water that is running, right? And so they have their own jobs, right? Their own, they do things rather than just being a label.
Well, it's one thing to just document an endangered language, but it's another thing entirely to really revive it, bring it back. What are the challenges to reviving the Kumeyaay language?
Getting to our children, allowing our elders to speak it as well. You know, we have to allow our elders to be in that space again, right? We have speakers that their peers, you know, they can't speak to their peers anymore, and allowing them to thrive now, right? And allowing them to speak to their grandchildren, their great-grandchildren, and furthermore, having spaces to use our language, to see our language used, and have that interaction, be interacting with the language rather than the language is separate from you.
You're also studying linguistics at CSU San Marcos. How are you bringing the Kumeyaay language into that space?
Yeah, so I've been very fortunate to have amazing professors. They, you know, they allow us to do projects on different languages. And so typically, I'm doing Kumeyaay, I'm doing Ipay. And so it's really, you know, getting in depth of how does a language work and how can we understand it to a higher level. And so using that in that space, and actually, you know, we had our new American Indian Student Center called the NEST, just opened at the CSUSM. And we also have the California Indian Culture and Sovereignty Center, and they've been supporting me as well. And getting language used throughout the spaces,
So in studying linguistics, you know, you're looking at all different types of languages, what they have in common, what distinguishes them. You were talking about how Kumeyaay describes things rather than names them. Are there other interesting things that, you've come to appreciate about Kumeyaay, the Kumeyaay language, that you've learned since studying linguistics?
So, you know, English, we have everything separated, right? It is a tree, you know? I could say it's just one word. Right? It's a lot of our phrases, a lot of our words can just be one word, be a whole sentence, right? And that's the one thing, you know, in English, we always have I, you, he, they, you know, we always have just one word, right? So I see you, a wu, right? Or nyo wu is I see you, just one word, right? I see it, a wu. It's just a little different. And so the language really, you know, it's so practical, simplistic, right? And so complex. And that it makes it so beautiful and so useful, right? And use it in so many applications. And I just think it's a wonderful, wonderful language.
Where do you speak it?
So I actually teach a class on the Semskal Indian Reservation. I've been, thankfully, my very grateful for my tribal council. They, you know, my tribal council, my chairman, Steve Cope. We have the chair of our culture committee, Johnny Bear Contreras. He's been, they've all been supporting me. So I'm doing a series of eight classes. We're on our fourth class, and getting people interacting with the language, talking to each other, right? We're having conversations. Yesterday we were going over locations, and so where is it, right? It's over here, or it's over there, and then giving commands, right? So give it, take it, you know, and actually interacting. So we have a fun game that I like to do is with a volleyball, right? And so we're in a circle, and we're like, okay, where's the ball, right? And I'm asking people, where's the ball? They're like, oh, it's right there, you know, boy, right? Over there. Or we have nyip right there, or right here, bi. And so they're interacting with the language. And it's not just, you know, a lecture, right? It's actually interacting with the language, using it in context, and having conversations. So every, probably like, so our classes are an hour and a half, and pretty much every 30 minutes we have a conversation. And so I do a whole review of what we learned, and then I'm like, okay, breakout conversations, let's do 5-10 minutes, right? and have at least two conversations. So 5-minute conversations, do everything that we've learned in the past 4 days, right? And so it gives them the opportunity to have conversations to use the language. And and then we have different events. So sometimes, you know, see some people who speak and we get to talk. And we have different meetings, right? And it's so fun. And it's really such a beautiful thing when we're able to do that, have conversations like that.
Since you started doing this work, what have you learned from other leaders in this movement around revitalizing languages?
So I think having community, really having community and having also different perspectives, right? We have so many different perspectives. Our stories have so many meanings, and we're able to learn so much from each other. Having that community to bring together, right? You know, a lot of our community gatherings, everyone has a job, right? So like the language, everything has a job. Everyone has a job. Everyone supports as a community. And really leaning into that community is so important. And because I don't just stay, you know, on my reservation. I go throughout all San Diego County, all throughout, you know, Kumeyaay country, and talk to our southern in Baja, you know, and talking to everyone and having that community, that, you know, combined strength rather than separating us all. Right?
What about this work is meaningful to you?
It's a connection, really is. It's a connection, you know, to our ancestors, to each other, to who we are, right? And getting to that connection with the world around us. And one thing is, when we say, pretty much, you know, a lot of people translate it to hello or greetings, is hauka, hauka. And that means, so in linguistically, breaking it down, it means au, which is fire, and ka, to go, right? There's different translations, but that's the translation I have. Mm-hmm. And it means fire, go. What does that mean, right? Mm-hmm. When we get down into context, we have, so our body is mat. The land is amat. Same word, basically, mm-hmm. right? So that's our creation story, shows that connection to the land that we have. Then our soul is mat hau, which is the fire within the body. So mat, fire, or mat is body, fire is au, right? Mat hau is the fire within the body. So when we're saying hauka, it means so much more than just, oh, hello, you know? It yeah. means a lot more. It means may the fire within you continue to burn, wow. right? And so it's that perspective, that worldview, that connection really is just allows us to open our eyes.
Yeah. I've been speaking with Nicholas Calloway Smith. He's an Ipai Kumeyaay educator and linguist. Nicholas, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
After the break, a new organization forms to raise awareness about missing and murdered Indigenous people in San Diego. Stay with us.
KPBS On Demand is supported by UC San Diego's Art Power, presenting Ginger Minj's Holiday Spectacular on December 5th and 6th at UC San Diego's Epstein Family Amphitheater. Tickets at artpower.ucsd.edu.
You're listening to KPBS Midday Edition. I'm Andrew Bowen, in for Jade Hindman. Across the region, Kumeyaay tribes and local groups are working to bring awareness to violence against Native communities. My next two guests are doing a lot of work to support community members affected by this issue. Danielle Bush is the program director at the nonprofit MMIP San Diego. That stands for Missing and Murdered Indigenous People. Also with us is Summer Elliott. She She's the Housing Services Liaison at the Strong-Hearted Native Women's Coalition. She's also a member of the Manzanita Band of the Kumeyaay Nation. And Danielle, Summer, welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
So according to the Bureau of Indian Affairs, Indigenous communities in the U.S. experience murder, rape, and violent crime at much higher rates than the national average. Can you talk about the issue of violent crimes against Native people in our region specifically? Summer, let's start with you.
Well, thank you guys for having us here today. I definitely think it's important that we bring up this topic. It definitely is not discussed as often. And so I just wanted to throw that out there and say thank you ahead of time. So definitely, I think that the history and trauma of Native American communities combined with racism and a lack of media attention is definitely an issue. When that happens, cases don't get the urgency as others. Like, family often wait too long on missing person cases to be taken seriously. Victims of violence may not get the support that they need. It creates an ongoing trauma in Native communities and makes people feel unsafe and unheard. So San Diego County has the largest Native American population in California and the highest number of federally recognized tribes. Because of this, the historic and systemic issues that cause MMIP nationwide are strongly felt. Sorry, I'm a little nervous. So San Diego County includes 18 reservations. And with all of this, we have different jurisdictional boundaries. And this also creates problems. So like tribal police may be limited to what crimes that they can prosecute. County sheriffs, state authorities, and federal agencies each have different responsibilities. Agencies often respond slowly because of jurisdiction issues. So cases fall through the crack and remain unsolved.
Mm. Danielle, anything to add to what Summer was saying?
You know, we have several active missing cases right now in San Diego. And I think it's important that we just continue to shed a spotlight on those and continue to help solve these cases and support those families.
And Danielle, MMIP San Diego started relatively recently to strengthen how our region responds to this issue. Can you talk about what your organization is and how you're filling in gaps?
Yes, absolutely. So MMIP San Diego started through a grant through the state of California led by the Jomo Indian Village in partnership with three other Kumeyaay tribes, Manzanita, San Pascual, and Suquan. And so those four tribes were working together, and we put on a summit at Viejas earlier this year in May. And since then, the MMIP San Diego has grown to be an intertribal coalition, like you said, working together to strengthen the response in the region. So we have 13 tribes now participating in monthly meetings and strategy calls to work towards that end. And so some of the initiatives that we're doing, we have prevention programs through Acorns to Oaks. We have an awareness campaign. We had over 40 billboards go up this year. Like I mentioned, we did the summit. We've done some radios, and we also have our website, mmipsd.org. And we're also doing some training and education programs. We have a lot that we're putting together next year in terms of trainings with the National Criminal Justice Training Center. We've been in talks with the Department of Justice. We want to do some search and rescue training next year in collaboration with the National Association of Search and Rescue, as well as the local law enforcement here in the Sheriff's Search and Rescue Academy. We have some things planned for collaboration for that.
Quite a bit of work. Summer, how is your group, the Strong-Hearted Native Women's Coalition, involved with MMIP San Diego?
So we're a 501c3 nonprofit organization that was established in 2005, and our coalition is one of 20 tribal coalitions that are recognized under VAWA. So we work to raise awareness against domestic violence, sexual assault, sex trafficking, stalking, dating violence, and MMIP. When we do the MMIP part, you know, we work with the families. If they reach out to us and ask for help, you know, we're boots on the ground. We help with flyers, and we walk them through the legal process, because sometimes that can be very intimidating, and you just don't know what to do. So we work with the families on that. We also work with, you know, other organizations to do things such as what Danielle was talking about, as far as like training and just bettering what we can do and how we can help, and, you know, drone training and all of that good stuff. So we, yeah.
Yeah. So it sounds like your work is really helping victims of crimes and loved ones of those victims advocate for themselves and navigate the jurisdictional boundaries that you were talking about. Can you expand more on the challenges that are specific to missing and murdered Indigenous people?
Absolutely. So, you know, here in San Diego, like I said, we're 18 reservations. They all have jurisdictional boundary issues. We're close to the border. And so, you know, there's a major hub for human trafficking here. We have tourism and military presence. We're next to the freeways. So trafficking is definitely major. Repeat the question. I do apologize.
Well, and I have another one for you, Danielle, and that's about cases being underreported. This is something that I think we've learned. Can you talk about why that is, or do we know why that is?
Well, I think that's a complex answer. I think the underreporting might go to, you know, sometimes there's a delay in cases and getting the information out. Sometimes there's a delay in the cases being taken seriously, and that can really impact the investigation. And I think that's a really important one to focus on. There's obviously, you know, as Summer mentioned, historical reasons why there's, you know, some trust in building those relationships and who to respond, and then the response that is given. And so working through bridging that and building those relationships. Also, the representation for Native women in the media when these cases happen, and getting the media to really spotlight the person that's going missing, so that attention can be shared, you know, widely, and also kind of put pressure on law enforcement to act quickly. So one of the things that the state of California has done through the California Highway Patrol, there's also now a specific alert called the Feather Alert. So when there is a missing person here in California, a Feather Alert can be activated. And we encourage everyone to share those on their social media. We'll share those on our social media, as well as you can get information on how to activate a Feather Alert on our website under Get Help on mmipsd.org.
I'd love to hear how both of you got into this work. Summer, you want to start?
Absolutely. So for me, it goes from my childhood. My father has very had a good impression in my life. He's very, you know, we do things because it's right or wrong, right? You always help people. When I was little, you know, he would pack extra food for me because, you know, maybe somebody at school, you know, needed an extra lunch. And that's the type of person that my father is. So for me, it's instilled from childhood. And so right is right and wrong is wrong. Excuse me. And when people go missing, that's absolutely wrong. When people are abused, when they're sold, when they're, you know, taken advantage of. So for me, this is definitely, you know, it affects my community. It affects me. It affects my family. And so I'm very big on this, and I will always be big on this. And that's where it came from.
Danielle?
Just to piggyback off what Summer says, this is such an important issue that needs all the voices that it can get for the voices that were stolen or taken too soon. And so I'm really honored to be a part of this important work and help amplify this. And like I said, work on solutions on how do we strengthen our response through San Diego County to this important issue and give a voice to the voiceless.
Summer, you knew some of those missing and their loved ones personally. Can you talk about who they were and how cases like theirs can be felt personally by a community as a whole?
Absolutely. So we have 8 active cases in San Diego County. Here in San Diego County, our men go missing at a higher rate than our women. A lot of people tend to think like, how is that possible? Men are strong. You know, you can't overtake a man, but that's not always the case. You know, there's many different factors. And so how it's felt in our community, it's a loss, right? A loved one is gone, a brother, a father, a cousin, just a community member. So there's a deep loss there. And the fact that they're going and we have no answers is just, it's horrible to think about, right? And so for me, I know four of them, whether I know them directly or I know their family. And so, you know, Forrest Boren is an enrolled member of Santa Isabel Reservation, and he went missing in October 16th, 2020. And then we have Kahara Henry, who's a member of the Sequon Reservation, and she went missing in July 21st in 2019. She was in Maui on vacation, and she went missing. And then Leroy Razo, he's went missing December 9th in 2018 in San Diego. We have Elijah Bear Diaz, who went missing August 29th, 2015, out of El Cajon, out of his home. And Joseph Scott, he went missing November 1st in 2009 out of his home in Paula, California. And then we have two other ones that I don't have permission from the family to speak on, but one was missing out of Palma and one was missing out of Ramona. Hmm.
What are some misconceptions around missing and murdered Indigenous people that you continue to hear? Danielle, you start?
Misconceptions around MMIP, I think, like I said, not getting the media attention. I think not being taken seriously when the cases occur. A lot of times we've heard from victims' families that they were not, the cases weren't given the seriousness. And as you know, in a missing persons investigation, that response needs to happen quickly. And so whether there was perceived stereotypes or something else involved in terms of drugs or that this person doesn't want to be found or different things like that, I think that really stalls the case and stalls justice. And so I think that's a really important one to be addressed, that every person matters and that that we need to be actively, you know, responding and providing support to those families.
Summer, do you hear misconceptions still?
Absolutely. So, again, I'm going to talk about the men because that's definitely what's happening here in San Diego County, you know, that they can't be overpowered. They can't be taken down. And that's definitely a misconception because men are vulnerable as well. You know, they are susceptible to domestic violence and different things. Which can cause, you know, somebody to go missing or to be harmed as well. And the fact that we don't get media coverage, you know, is major. It's not a misconception, but it's like, you know, why don't we get this media coverage? I definitely think it's something that we should talk about too.
What are your organizations doing to honor Indigenous loved ones that were lost to violence who are still missing? Danielle?
Some of the things that we're doing, we are working closely with Strong-Hearted Native Women's Coalition because they are the boots on the ground doing a lot, you know, of advocacy work with the families and so appreciated the work that they're doing. And so working with them to get permission from the families to have, you know, a page on our website that honors them. We had this summit in May where we wanted to honor the families of loved ones that's gone missing, continuing to do the advocacy work for this and bringing awareness to the issues. And again, wanting to strengthen this response and help families get justice are all things that are goals of our organizations, I think both of them. And like I said, Strong-Hearted has been a huge part of helping us get there with that.
When somebody's missing, it may not be a confirmed case that they're not coming back, but, or, you know, the family may know, but you still want to find that loved one. What we offer, what we do is, you know, we'll do a court accompaniment. We'll be with them from beginning to end. You know, sometimes you just need somebody to stand next to you, to be next to you, you know. We do like MMIP summits, you know, we encourage the family to come and to talk about this and to constantly bring their missing loved one's case to the forefront, right? To constantly remind the public, because that's the way we have to do it, to remind the state, to remind law enforcement. And when we aren't with the family, we're doing it for them. You know, we're, you know, in Washington and traveling different places, places like this, and we're bringing that attention.
Yeah. Well, I've been speaking with Danielle Bush, Program Director at the nonprofit MMIP San Diego, and Summer Elliott, Housing Services Liaison at the Strong-Hearted Native Women's Coalition. We'll also include the resources mentioned at kpbs.org/midday. Danielle, Summer, thank you so much for sharing your time with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's our show for today. I'm your host, Andrew Bowen, in for Jade Hindman. Thanks for listening to Midday Edition. Have a great day.
KPBS On Demand is supported by the San Diego County Toyota Dealers, presenting a new 2025 Tundra designed to combine performance and comfort with up to 437 horsepower and 10-speed automatic transmission. See your Toyota dealer, the San Diego County Toyota Dealers. We make it easy.